foraying into perhaps religion a little bit, and but really looking at all of them and the nature of who we say brought those religions and how we look at how those beings acted. And it has everything to do ultimately with being happy today, I hope. So I don't wish to dwell in the abstract too long, but it's from the angle of Buddha being iconoclastic when it comes to his understanding is in a way a response.
I'm going to be straight with you. I don't totally understand I don't totally know the word iconoclastic.
Oh, great. So we're going to get to it. So you'll get it in a second here. So this is for me, Buddha is an example of an iconoclastic leader who came and challenged notions of karma and dharma, religious ideas in the milieu that he found himself. Jesus Christ challenged quote-unquote Jewish or unquote-unquote Jewish ideas and ossifications, things that had gotten hardened within the religions, and tried to not just update them, but bring them into the present and challenge them deeply. Same thing.
Iconoclast, noun, a person who attacks cherished beliefs or institutions, to a destroyer of images used in religious worship.
Oh, that's a lovely addition. So we're in the realm of idolatry, and I want to talk to you because you're sensitive to the possibility of anyone and any adherent in any religion to believe that religion has the ultimate truth, and to then reify that, to make it this fixed, self-existent thing outside, which is ironic because the religion came to actually question the very act that humans do called reification. Why that matters is what I'd like to talk about, and how religion has both created an excess, an ironic, beyond ironic, contradictory set of folks who seem to practice idolatry thinking they're not. And and then also it's created a lot of free thinking individuals that seem to understand how humans do construct ideals and then kindly say, hey, that may be a facet, but we have to also speak of the unknown God, the one who has no face. And we always begin in love and mercy. We begin in love and mercy. And then we get into this, an active iconoclasm with our own set of beliefs.
I mean, it's even there in the orthodoxy, right? I mean, in
yes,
in Judaism, that you can't speak the name, right? You write down, you know, this inscrutable combination of syllables in Hebrew, and then you pronounce it in some whole other way, which is Adonai. And maybe, and then, I don't know if it's like Yahweh is an attempt to pronounce what is written as, it's like ya or something, ya, which, right, with the Jews don't say, right? It seems like there's
an YHWH.
Same. You're not supposed to, you know, make any image. Of course, the Islamic tradition also is a reformation.
Exactly.
Right. We don't think of Judaism that way typically, right?
Well, in a sense, Judaism is our father, is the monotheistic father in the sense of really questioning all of humans' ideas of what the highest ideal is and being like, hey, guys, there's something way past that none of us know about. And it really cleans the heart when we don't land on our own ideas about what ultimate love is or who God, that we remain in some sort of openness that allows
In the Hindu tradition too, right? Like, I don't know if it's wrong to, you know, my temptation is to say like kind of a final evolution of the Hindu tradition still, right? Mm-hmm. Which is almost a meaning of the word Vedanta. Mm-hmm. Right, the final form of understanding of the Vedas, that about Nirguna Brahman, the God or the ultimate reality beyond all descriptions we could ascribe, that we can only say neti neti, not this, not that.
Yeah,
But they still say Satchitananda. I think you would still, it's not clear to me whether or not Satchitananda, we would have to ask a better expert than I, perhaps, whether or not Satchitananda, truth, reality,
bliss,
you know, awareness, you know, consciousness and bliss are they still attributable to Nirguna Brahman? Are those qualities, or are those qualities which are beyond all qualities? It's not.
And I think that the Christian tension comes out with, and you're a child of God, and you're born for this intense glory, and you also have to enter into your own nothingness. You have to enter into the, yeah. So you have this tension of like, oh yeah, you're there. There is this mercy and love, and at the same time, there's this intense negation that goes on. Or when Moses says to, you know, who shall I say? I am that I am. Tell them that being sent you. Okay, tell them I am. They're not going to buy that. What do you mean? I am that I am. Or then in the Upanishad, I am that. You know these. So, but what is all this? Like even, and well, just sort of almost setting it up right now to get into why it even matters to talk about this. If, you know, maybe we can look at also Tao Te Ching and Lao Tzu and Chuang Tzu as being truly, in a sense, mystics pushing up against being iconoclastic yet again. And is there something in the very nature of being that has to engage in a healthy Manjushri, like, you know, wisdom, wield a sword, a compassionately wield a sword that is, in a sense, iconoclastic moment to moment. That there's something about the people who brought these things that became religions that both supported that quest and also went in the exact opposite direction.
I like that there's something in particular, you know, I'm better versed in my own tradition than other, you know, in the Buddhist tradition.
Yeah.
But also that I see echoed in the Christian tradition, that this idea that we're sinners, that we, you know, part of what is central to understanding one's relationship with God is to understand that we're a sinner. And just as in the Buddhist tradition, we are in a state of ignorance, and to come to an understanding that you're in a state of ignorance is not to get out of a state of ignorance. You could have a state of understanding theoretically in Buddhism, in which you're free of ignorance, but you ain't there, and it'll be a big deal when you get there, and don't think you're there before you're there, because you're not. So every time you think you understand, that should be built in with understanding that you don't understand, because the teaching is no, you don't.
And it sets a roadblock up in the heart. It actually kind of messes with our actual energies and our being, and our world is less harmonious. It has such vast ramifications.
The lack of understanding, you mean, or the sin, or reminding ourselves that we have that lack of understanding?
The humility that is brought about by a healthy self-distrust that is not an engagement in low self-esteem, bashing, and flagellation. Mm-hmm. A really, truly healthy, like, I do not know. And boldly saying, and yet I have to paint my highest ideal and try to live into it, recognizing that it's but a facet, and it's a facet that's constantly being repainted. And it doesn't see the iconoclast in when they're religious, leaves you hoping, leaves you in a state of expectant joy, Satchit Ananda, beatitude. And the Prophet Muhammad came and preached the dunya, samsara, the fallen world. All these people who ended up starting religions, whether they, you know, did Jesus really come to start a religion? Like, it just seems like how could it be? Anything that would pop up and say, we have something, a religion has to be working against itself to be a religion in a way. And so there's a built-in contradiction to the academy, the institution, the human endeavor, and we have to live with it. It's part of our world. It's not like to do away with it, but I don't know, to become more aware of it, I guess.
Right. Or, the Pharisees, to reject the Pharisees in a sense, but then to reject the indelicate rejection of the Pharisees, to come back and say, well, what is in the tradition? You know, okay, you're so savvy that you've moved away from tradition, but, and we see a lot of people, right, in the spirit, and it's a pet peeve of mine. And, you know, maybe this is me holding on to my efforts at scholarship, half-hearted though they be, but that I, when I see someone being creative without scholarship, I find it distasteful. I want to see you do the scholarship and then be creative, you see? So, you know, Jesus, you know, as a teacher, right, in my experience of Jesus, right, like, seems to have been versed, right, like deeply versed, deeply raised, deeply versed in the traditions. And then the branching out or the rejection, right, the iconoclastic, right, bent is informed by, you know, the intimacy with what is being rejected, which seems to be the same with Lord Buddha as well.
Or more deeply, being folded in and transformed so that it doesn't look like what it was. And what I mean by that is, like, I mean, you would say karma. Okay, yeah, action, absolutely. But karma, a movement of the mind? Oh my gosh. Or Christianity. Sure, the kingdom of God, but within? Oh dear. Oh God, I'm a temple. Oh, wait. Okay, that's it. So it, iconoclism, I want to say it almost like that, like it's a ism, like it's a form, iconocology, like the there's types that seem to dismember, like a postmodernist thinker or an absurdist thinker might dismember and not leave the potential for vision or vision itself. Prophetic thought has a role within religious iconoclastic thinking that I see in Lao Tzu, Xuan Tzu, Buddha, Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, and Lord Jesus Christ. So, and Lord Buddha, they all seem to have done this. And then, I don't know, are we supposed to then try to...
Well, and Jetson Kamba, you know, interestingly, you see, right in the, you know, whatever, the 1400s, you know, this Tibetan monk who makes a, who has some realizations, has some experiences, you know, is in the fold, folds into himself, has realizations, and leads a reformation in Buddhism that goes back towards more classical forms, especially of monasticism and morality. Mm-hmm. So, right. I mean, to say, you know, iconocology, you know, or make an ism of it, right? It's cute because it makes an idol.
It's ironic. Yes.
exactly. Of the bashing of idols. To say, you know, if you meet the Buddha in the road, then kill him.
Yeah. And I think you and I would reach out to sisters and brothers who we like in the people, like it seems that that is going on. Like you are actually making, it seems that that happens in my world a lot, where we're making the very thing that is meant to dismantle our tendency towards seeing things as in one way or as fixed, as some,
right,
that we're that it actually is feeding that. And it's very heartbreaking because it's like, wait a minute, the methodologies in the very religion you're studying, which by the way, you seem to have thrown out a little bit, some of us, like there are methods and they all seem to want us to be doing the opposite of thinking we know. So I don't know what something's going
especially
wrong.
Especially if they happen prematurely, you know, like that saying, right? If you meet the Buddha in the road, kill him. Like I think of, you know, new practitioners hearing that, and before they know what it would mean to interact with a Buddha, or before they have an idea of what Buddhism is or what Buddhism would mean, you see, they're already saying, well, I heard if you meet a Buddha in the road, kill him, so I shouldn't study or understand. And this is an earlier side. I think you're talking about the other end, which is where you do get steeped in something, and then you learn about rejecting something, and then you throw
integrate
bathwater.
Mm.
Right. Well, this would be the critique I'm saying would be thrown.
The critique, absolutely. Absolutely. And that is beautifully said. And I don't suggest, like, for example, how do we then take this to our children? I took a role with my children to never be a capital B Buddhist at the table or say Buddhist prayers. I would say a prayer sometimes to mystery, or I did intentionally keep it vague, because for whatever, for better or for worse, that we need to build our own ideals, and it's God that crushes them with God's help and rebuilds us. And I don't, for me, I don't, this unknown love, that whole, I couldn't in good conscience sit there at the table and be like, we're going to do this. And sometimes we'd hold hands or we'd do Thanksgiving a certain way. So there's a sense in which the household was outwardly pagan, but it was inwardly very devoted. Like my children are seeking, and it's very beautiful to witness that by giving that room, they seem to be coming round more and more to love. And I do sometimes, like, gosh, I didn't take them to church. They could have done We Three Kings, and I missed all these years. They could have been hearing about mercy and faith and truth and love without anything being forced down them. And this heartbreak happens in my heart about, just, there's this temple that we call this Christian church, but people say these beautiful things in it, you know, and wow, and we have each other's backs when we die, and we deliver this bread and this wine, and we take care of each other in this kind of simple way that has faith, a really simple faith that actually isn't that complicated, you know? So it's such a strange thing to talk about what we're talking about and what it means to integrate it and why it would maybe even matter. And I do want to throw science in, because it's so absolutely beautiful, holy, sacred. And just to say to the scientist in myself, that you are also creating a noetic, a metaphysic, by the very things we choose to look at and the questions we choose to ask. This is not a big idea. You have talked about it very eloquently over a decade together. Like, it's a totally a part of science. And so I do feel that science is also included within my notion of religious thought and idolatry. Like, yeah, to what extent does a scientist create an idol of what is taken to be factual?
I think that you and I have an interest, a sympathy towards religion and science together, which,
yes,
I think is lacking or wanting, wherein we're in a lot of other people, wherein I think we're both willing to sort of equivocate on the meaning of each of these things, to say that if some truth is discovered, that science means truth, you see, and religion means truth, in that it's right. You would say salvific, right? Like, or not. Like, if it doesn't work towards salvation, then it's false religion. If it doesn't work, and thus truth, and thus not science.
Yes.
And so if we make new discoveries about what is, in terms of, you know, that which exists or doesn't, in terms of ontology, in terms of, you know, epistemology, you know, in terms of the means of knowledge, or in terms of what will, you know, liberate us from our misery or bring us to bliss or salvation or not, then the meaning of truth now must include that. And thus the meaning of science must include that, and the meaning of religion must now include that.
But now I want to just pull back from that must, in the sense of, at the very least, can we as scientists admit that we've narrowed an infinite field and we've taken a facet of what appears to be the objective world and made statements about it that appear to be true and often work over and over again, or seem to always work. But within such a, the way we're seeing color right now, as I'm looking out into the forest, I am not seeing all the colors. I believe that to be true because science has told me so, and so has mysticism. Mm-hmm. And so science, you see, it seems like scientists are the most open. People who say they're like, even self-defined atheists, I don't even know if that's the right term. It feels like we need another term for who we're talking about right now, like you and I, science and religion, because they're just not at odds. They seem to be such allies in the, anyhow, it's allies doesn't even do it. I mean, you just kind of even broke down the notion of allies by saying, look, there maybe is a science to this getting more filled with bliss and happy. And there maybe really is. And if it's geared towards something that will be salvific.
And no, totally. I mean, I feel like I'm in the same business, you know, like when I meet that sort of, an atheist or
that sort of an atheist, yeah.
That sort of a scientist, wherein it's not just that they have an atheist bent in the sense of an aloofness, right? But when there's someone who says, "Well, I don't accept this concept. I was taught this concept of God or this concept of God, and I don't accept that, but I do accept that we're here together. There's stuff to deal with. There are situations that arise." It's hard. I want people to be well. What can we do about it? Then we're in the same business, you see? And then dialogue is easier then, you see, than someone who has the arrogance of satisfaction that they have arrived at some simple platitude that is a truth that somehow everyone is just walking around oblivious to, and they're just fine, and they sit comfortably above the fray of life's pain because Jesus Christ is their Lord and Savior, or because it's all coming from karma, or because
they have some special secret knowledge, or
right, but, yeah,
and
right.
any fill in the blank,
right?
They
totally.
Have, an, they have a nice
I
house.
Just
they
knew have a that, job. And I wouldn't have to fear, you know, traffic or something. You know, there's.
Or that, disease,
or yeah, right for yeah, right for example,
or,
yeah,
or, in particular, or maybe death is what, you know,
right. Right, yeah, right, yeah, exactly. And you know, you and I were also both influenced at an early age by the what now seem like the lazier imaginations of Alan Wallace, or not Alan Wallace. God bless him. Sorry, Alan Wallace.
God bless him.
Watts.
Yes.
Alan Watts, The Wisdom of Insecurity, right? That's the name of his big, his most popular book, I think.
Yes.
Am I right about that? It is, right?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, it's okay. Everyone will forgive me if I'm wrong, probably. And that again, this, like, what does it take to... That had a big influence on me. This idea, and it seems to be built into Taoism, or at least the way it was taught by, you know, hippies in the 50s and 60s. It seemed to be in the sort of naked, weak ass Buddhism that I was originally taught. Because you hear the Heart Sutra before knowing what the Heart Sutra is about, and you know, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no nothing, no nothing, no none, no no, not that, not this, not this, not neti, 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 right? And then you're like, well, okay, well, what then? You're like, yeah, okay, now you're ready to leave the temple, you know, when you're in a state of, okay, well, what then? And
then in a sense, the wisdom of insecurity sets up what you and I have been involved with, and you continue to be deeply involved with, which is Tibetan Buddhism, and the particular branch being the Gelugpa Prasangika Matyamika, in which Jason Kapa is his expertise. This is the main subject. I mean, the wisdom of insecurity and what Alan Watts talks about is, to me, ultimately, in a sense, largely explained by Jason Kapa.
How do you relax into that, right? Like, how do you, I, you know, there's a state, like you felt this state at moments in your life where you, I think some of the big breakthrough moments in my life were when I felt this sort of, you know, terrifying intensity of not knowing and expectations upon me by those around me of who to be and how to be, and then catching this glimpse in their eyes and having this dawning realization of, oh, you don't know either. Like, none of us know. Oh, it's okay. Like, it would be the only way I could truly be wrong. And I make an idol of that by saying truly, but the only way I could truly be wrong is by thinking I know.
Yes.
You see, and now, yes. And now, like, just this, you know, this golden road to freedom opens up that goes in, you know, in a perfectly straight line and at the same time, all directions at once. And I have the freedom to express and explore and discover all at once.
And then understanding that because we're in the dunya, the samsara, the fallen world, and we're sinners, we're going to constantly be creating projections and idols and responding to phantoms and spinning anxiety around a self that isn't ultimately findable, and then needing to talk to each other about this, live it, search it, because there is a way in which we almost have to engage in that healthy self-dismantlement every day. And that maybe that really is prayer. It's kind of reaching into one's own nothingness and then feeling a gratitude for it's a constant process. It's like those martial artists who get their shins hit over and over again until finally I don't know, there's something to it like that. We have to, like what Rainer Maria Rilke in Letters to a Young Poet said, young man, you have to hold the difficult, or else, you know, things will get very, very difficult if you don't hold to the difficult. And I think holding to the difficult is accepting the weight of this constant, graceful reinvention of self that is is necessarily going to be pulled into conventions. And maybe that convention is actually an obedience that is letting go of the self. So it doesn't have a look. It doesn't have an eye. It doesn't have a way it looks. It's the specific fragment and light of each being and that particular color that being is going to emit. It's not like, I think sometimes people, I used to make a mistake of thinking, well, we all become like Jesus, or all become Buddhism, we're all the same. It's more like, I think we're utterly peculiar and transcendentally ourselves, like truly ourselves. And it's not in contradiction to the symphony of, you know, one love, of all being in a sense, Satchit Ananda, a state of harmony.
There's a compassion to me in the teaching that only an enlightened being can hold both, you know, deceptive or conventional, you know, normal, ordinary truth and ultimate truth at the same time. That it's okay. Of course I can. Like, I am working in the realm of conception. I'm working in the realm of temporary truths, provisional truths, and I will not be able to perfectly maintain the awareness that every truth I interact with is provisional. Like, I can't do both at once. I could go for a moment. I could have that understanding. I could sit and realize that there is no truth that I could settle into that's not merely provisional. Or I can act in the world and be swept up. And I'll be swept up. You'll be swept up. It's okay. You'll be swept up. There may come a day when you're not, they say.
But it's just, yeah.
But you ain't there. And it's okay. It's okay. You ain't there. You're going to get swept up, and we can keep coming back, and we can sit in the morning or speak with a friend or go into a cave, my son, you see, or spend time remembering, oh yeah. I got swept up again. You're going to get swept up again. The truths that you arrive at allow you to function, allow you, your interaction with these idols, you see, they're only false because we think that there's something more than they are. They're not false, you know.
Right. And this goes to the next subject to me, which is, okay, these are, to pick up on Thomas Merton, these are the conjectures of two guilty bystanders, you know, and also deeply involved. Like, there's something about our engagement right now that assumes certain, we can arrive at truths, as you just said, because then it informs how we act in the world. What would be some of those truths? And these truths seem to involve methodology. And when we get into methodology and away from God and metaphysics, but into the methodology that is informed by the perspective metaphysic of Hinduism, Vedanta, or Buddhism, or Taoism, they all seem to involve a renunciation. They all seem to involve truths. And so another one of the casualties of a perverted iconoclastic effort, a revolutionary effort that leaves no vision in its wake of destruction, is this, I mean, and we're in that kind of a death cult. The misunderstood Christianity is almost a death cult. Capitalism is built into it too. And that's another subject. But to, suffice to say, I'm sitting here. These are the conjectures of a guilty bystander who's trying to engage in some kind of self-distrust that will allow some sort of dialogue that could bring us to truth. It's not the negation of truth. It's the and it's also not the negation of specific truths. And it's in the methodologies of these religions that we've been talking about, and that I, and I believe you, so dearly love and have spent my life in and around and along with science. I really have to include that as a ciencia, and ciencia needs to also be part of theology. Like we have to merge these terms without losing the distinctions.
Science is a yoga. It's bringing the mind back again and again and inquiring again and again from an angle that reveals truths upon which we can stand to better ourselves, and that is constantly ready to reassess those truths and constantly ready to reanalyze. But there, it's not, it is goal oriented. It is, you know, replicable means of betterment is
the, and to destroy ourselves as with religion.
Easily.
Absolutely. And then I don't even think we know often the creeds that give birth to beautiful liturgies, those very structures within church and in ritual environment, whether they be red people, whether they be yellow people, whether brown or black, white, all the peoples of the earth, and the certain spiritual regimens they put themselves through is precisely to enter into the mystery of being and to leave with a merciful heart that realizes you're screwed and fucked like everyone else is, and realizes, my gosh, we're all in a sense, you said it like 3 weeks ago before we started doing this podcast. You spoke it. We're all, in a sense, the chosen people on a spiritual journey, knowing they are, no matter whether they're scientists or voodoo, doesn't matter. The chosen are those who know they're Pharisees. It's ironic. It's not about putting down some sect some Jewish sect 2,000 years ago. The point is, you come to your temple as a Pharisee and say, God, help me. Friends, help me to not judge that person who just changed gender and wants me to call her by they. My God, God help me from that. Idolatry. God help me from the harm that comes from thinking I know. Please, really, I need this place of worship. But goodness, don't go thinking the bloody place of worship has the goods, but also don't go thinking it doesn't, or else why would you show up? So it's right. Like we're it's untenable, Ben. What do I do? It's like a rock in a hard place. This life.
Sure. How many books are written on the topic of that the profound cannot be discussed, cannot be written of? You know, how many books are written on the top? How many sermons given to say I can't teach you anything? And then how misunderstood that is, that you know that the dogma of insecurity that. Somehow
the dogma of insecurity.
Can never know and walk away, you know,
and
have
not
to
study.
Right. And the second you think you know something, you're an idiot. But there's truth to that. It's not that that's wrong, but it doesn't mean that you shouldn't study.
Indeed.
And the more informed you are, you do expand your toolbox of misleading avenues that may well serve you. And it's not, it's not the avenue that's right or wrong. It's us that are right or wrong, and or right and wrong. And see, it starts to sound like a bunch of damn nonsense.
Yeah, it does. That's right. Like we've been like Alan Watts. It would often start to break down. It would start to okay. So now, what are we talking about again?
Yeah. This came up. You know, Kendra and I did a gig, and they asked us to teach on the last day about the Gita, and so we talked about this verse, you know, where Lord Krishna talks about going, you know, reaching the Brahma beyond, you know, the Brahman that is beyond words. And we had this shtick, you know, that we're ready to teach about, like, don't get carried away. And the day before we taught this thing, maybe the last teaching before we taught this thing, the teacher who's teaching the overall teaching goes on this tirade about, like, I can't teach you yoga. We just did a year training. I can't teach you anything. I can't teach you yoga. You can only discover it yourself. Nothing anyone says is worth anything ever. You know, you shouldn't listen to anyone, anything, you know, anything anyone says later, you know. And of course, our shtick going into this, like, you know, the second I hear beyond the Brahman of words, I want to get, you know, I want to push back. I want to say, if you claim a thing to be beyond words, then that can't be true about that thing. Then those words can't apply to the thing. The words beyond words are words, which you're trying to apply to the thing beyond words, which means it couldn't be beyond words if it's really beyond words. And the thing can't be indescribable if it's indescribable, because then that would be a description of the thing. And so it couldn't mean that. It just couldn't be that simple. It can't be as simple as to say that a thing is indescribable. But experience is really quite something. We talked about looking through a telescope at Saturn, the first time you look through a telescope at Saturn, and you've been told, right, that there's a thing in the sky and it's got rings around it. But you look through some, you know, metal and glass, and shit messes you up. I mean, just for a second, you're like, whoa, no, you know, like, whoa, no, it can't, you, that there's nothing, no amount of description, no, even seeing pictures in books, there's just nothing quite like that moment where you take this incredibly simple technology, you know, this incredibly simple technology, and peer through it, and there's a thing in the sky and it's got rings around it. And you just, now you just can't get around that. The way that truth is installed in you when you come face to face with it in a way that's beyond words, which is exactly not beyond words, because I just described it. And it's not that experience. And you did not just look through a telescope and see Saturn because I talked about that experience.
And it seems that when people have a taste of this unspeakable mystery, there is sometimes a deep desire, hopefully out of love, to share it. Like you see Augustine, you know, I can't say anything about it, and then write 10,000 pages, you know. It just happens over and over again, these examples of something can happen when you see that planet. There's something that changes in you that is quite beyond words. And so it seems to me that we can kind of always hold both and be toggling, because I don't believe we as human beings, I believe maybe there's a state that is not that toggle, but you know, I'll know it when I know it.
Well, you hope, you know, like the threat is knowing it and being wrong. And that does seem to happen to people, that people decide that they know it.
I guess I was referring to looking through the telescope and knowing that you just actually saw the planet like that. And I think that even people who get really close, when you look at, for example, one of the ways to look at the history of Western thought is through the councils that happened at Nicaea and Ephesus, and to see this, I mean, obviously that's just one facet of all the transformations that were happening on minds on that planet, but suffice to say, within, it seems to have influenced much of European thought and thought in the U.S. and thought in, around to some extent. So the extent that it's been an influence, these councils, you know, you hear them. They're fighting about these very ideas about epistemology, meaning how do we come to know, and how do we protect the mind from, like, thinking it it knows or thinking it's had some realization that in fact it hasn't. And it can really hurt people. Right. Like the way our teacher, we had a teacher together, right? And so it's like, you know, you do preparation for a heart surgeon, but when you go to the surgeon who wants to speak about the unspeakable, well, if there hasn't been a taste, if there hasn't been some sort of sense of looking through that microscope and doggone seeing those rings, it could go horribly wrong. And even if there is a taste and it's thought that that's the whole taste, horribly wrong. And so
it's so tricky to say that we know if we've had a taste or not. And that, it's
and that
so hard
too.
To
thank you.
Even looking through the telescope.
Yes.
Right, like you, okay, you have this, right? It's a good example of a mundane noetic experience, right? Where you're looking through this and you know in a different way for the first time that that's sad. And it doesn't mean I couldn't have been fooled. It doesn't mean that it's still, now it's out of the question that I'm somehow wrong about Saturn. No, that would be going too far. There's still some, I don't know why. I don't know why some, you know, squirrely thing could have happened where I'm wrong. And you know, the little, you know, the beautiful teaching that you, even in those moments, right, that Buddhism gives, that even in those moments, you come back down, you come down, you descend. From that, you step back to the fallen world, as it were, your own heart, you see, back to your own inner, inner fallen kingdom, you see, that you must descend back into. And it's tragic, it's seemingly tragic, but to know that, to carry that. Oh, the distrust of our distrust of distrust to, okay, we've had this breakthrough into what's not true about the world or what is true about the world. And then.
And that ties into last week. How much do we perseverate on it? How much do we feed what we think was a true vision? Something true in that. How much do we engage in that and share it? And what is this casting of pearls before swine? And who is the swine, and should we cast them? And that came into even my trepidations around beginning this endeavor with you.
Yeah.
And it just, it's so possible to get prideful in the wrong way. I want to say maybe there is a divine pride. Maybe there is a something like that. But there is a beautiful sense in starting in Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Every chapter in the Quran, the whole Quran starts. We begin in the name of Allah, who is merciful and compassionate. And even the Rahman and Rahim there, to triconsonantal root, R, H, and M. You see these capital R, capital H, and it refers to the womb, to the woman's womb, to female womb. We begin in this tenderness. And now I'm going to tell you about how you're going to die and how you need to pray and give you some of the tough love. But it's always within the milieu of this merciful womb. And I question the ability to come to reality without that understanding. So I'm not saying one has to have it. I just say, for me, a world that's simply blank or random, which I am projecting onto better and better stories that lead to better and better outcomes, that particular narrative doesn't satisfy my soul completely, though I think it an important one, and I do indeed lean on it. But I do think that it is another narrative, in the same way that Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim is a narrative. Yeah. And I sometimes think that that first narrative I spoke of claims that it's narrative-less. And that's a beef I have, you know, to talk about, to potentially reduce to causality, to understand causality more deeply, or to speak of the random, and or to speak of the empty and the available, and then to say, you know, my story that's placed upon that blank screen amounts to nothing more or less than Bismillah ar-Rahman. That's a story too, placed on a blank screen. Maybe that is the key to overcoming idolatry and my pushing back against it.
It doesn't look to me like the founder of that tradition, or the whatever renovator, rediscoverer of that, you know, Arya Nagarjuna, right, was necessarily making that mistake. And it's funny, I remember having a discussion with someone early on that sort of the popular accusation of Aryanagarjuna is that somehow he has made this idol of emptiness. He's saying that nothing ultimately exists, but then he says emptiness is ultimate truth. But I don't.
And
I don't
absurdist, think that's a, and thus absurdist. Right. Yeah, yeah. But, and it's he's not.
It's not a close reading of Nagarjuna, you know. And, I mean, it's not he got the joke. It sure looks like he got the joke. Of course, that's another narrative. If one single thing he says is not empty, then nothing at all can be empty. You see, of course, emptiness is also a narrative. Of course, it is.
It would have to be because it couldn't be shared if it wasn't.
Of course,
because it's being shared.
Because it's something we can talk about, because it's something we can think about, because it can be an object, which is true, because it can be an object of awareness, or else it cannot be known. And so, of course, the idea, you see, that truth is beyond all narratives is a narrative. Of course, the idea that the idea of truth, that the idea that there could be such a thing as truth is a narrative, you see, is another narrative. And the idea that there couldn't be such a thing as truth is a narrative that may serve us in certain contexts.
Which is a little contradictory, because the very statement itself would then not be really statable.
Yeah.
Which is exactly right. So it's true that nothing is true? Oh, but you just said nothing is true. So you've just contradicted your very... Yeah, yeah. So then you're stuck there, right? Doesn't that lead to, like, I want to see the rings? Like, wait a minute, there's something going on now. Like, you just did this beautiful meditation, this kind of... if you will, kind of a jokum or a shargum, actually, a kind of a serial, like you carried us into this place. And then that leaves me too with wanting to taste, like have direct experience. It really does, the engagement in this doesn't lead to there's no truth. It leads to, oh my gosh, let me keep seeking with my head bowed down. Like really, like, oh my gosh, there's something to this. You know, it doesn't leave you in an absurdist place. Master Nagarjuna never feels like that to me when you read it, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel like that. It feels like he's trying to break a pattern of thinking that is really hurting us. You know, a way of believing our own stories about others, believing what we tell ourselves about our neighbor who just won't come around to how loving I am. Or whatever he just really helps to clean us of assumptions, I guess. The assumptive mind, the mind that makes assumptions.
Some of the sweetest moments in my life, I feel like, have been where I was confident in my lack of confidence, and yet that can't hold, right? Like you. Mm. You can't help but become overconfident in that, right? To the point of the discussion. No, it can't. It can't hold. It becomes a new thing to stand on, and it, like you would say, right? Another false idol, and to talk about what is beyond all those things. To say that somehow I could have an understanding, whatever provisional understanding of. What is beyond all provisional understanding? Yeah, right. It sounds nonsensical, but it's what we're aiming at.
And so, indeed.
Yeah. So somehow how to hold in my mind all day this uncertainty and skepticism of skepticism, you know, wouldn't I just make a new idol of that? And then I'd have to be skeptical of that again. Like you said, what, you know, we're going to die and an awareness of our death, but an awareness of our death in every instant is more radical. An awareness of the death of understanding in every instant, an awareness that there is no smallest instant that progresses in which everything doesn't have to be revised. Not this samsara in which everything is... Mm. happening for the countless fifth time, but a samsara in which there has also never been an instant in in history that isn't entirely fresh, that isn't, that hasn't broken every rule statistically, you see, in being the first moment that ever happened like this.
And fresh to the extent to which it seems all that has been is both there and not there in its fresh. Its freshness isn't contingent upon some mystical break with the past. It's a folding in from, I don't even know. I made a mistake in seeking, you know, chop wood, carry water. Yes, there's a way in which wood and water and nails and hammers and design and children and all that we do are portals. There's a way in which, but it has to be all of it. It's not some steady state. It's not some, I've lost the train of the
thought. Well, it's all true, but none of it complete. You know, all of these things are true, and none of these things are enough to allow us to stop seeking truth. And there's this wisdom in the seeking, and there's this wisdom in watching the unfolding of mystery that you mustn't be satisfied. It seems you mustn't be ever totally satisfied. I mean,
the way up is the way down. Like you go down to go up. It's sort of contra. There's a way in which this conversation, we're constantly pulling ourselves back from various brinks, or so we think so. You know, maybe we haven't identified the brinks at all, and there's more. There's brinks upon the brinks that you haven't. There's you know, whole frontiers that you haven't even investigated. You know, of course there must be. It must be so. But the feeling after this should be in me, I think, or could be one of like a kind of a humility
after. The seeker after truth should be humbler than the dust. The world crushes the dust under its feet, but the seeker after truth should be so humble himself that even the dust could crush him.
Shri Guru Charana Saroja Raja Nija Mana Mukuru Sudari. Medieval Hindi. I bow to the dust at your lotus feet. I bow to the dust under the soles of your feet. I look for my face, Mukuru. I bow to that. This is just like this devotion of Hanuman to Krishna, or of a disciple to a teacher, that is obviously so tricky, but it's a very beautiful, reminding me of what you just said.
There's this temptation, right, for humility to mean self-deprecation or denigration, but it seems clear that there should be a way of understanding this humility in which it is the good news that you would go door to door.
And it's the sweetest moment you just spoke about, you know, like the sweetest moment is when I've lacked confidence. Like it's such, what a straight, what the heck do you mean about that?
Right.
You know, it's actually finally, it's a realistic examination of self based on, it's just realistic to start in the boo-boo that I am and the boo-boos I make. It's just a realistic place to start. Within, though, for me, I can't do that within the milieu of the random. I do it within the milieu of a deep faith in love, in God, in Rahman and Rahim and mercy, in deep faith in the dust beneath my teacher's feet. I really start in those narratives. And without them, I can't seem to.
But random is not nonsensical. I mean, no scientist worth two shits, right? No atheist worth two shits, you know, can affirm random, you know, no one.
I've been using that word carelessly.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying, I know it's a thing, you know, but there is some to that, like what, you know.
Yeah, let's go into the science then of it, like a real. Let me say a reality where it simply is, I want to say reduced to cause and effect, or reduced to our understanding of cause and effect. I don't know. Okay. you know, riff on that, Ben. You know, like, yeah. I need.
It does take a little bit more savvy of a scientist to realize the limitations of our capacity to solve cause and effect. And then that, you know, there are all these solutions that sneak in around the margins when cause and effect is just too complex.
There's all these solutions that sneak in around the margins.
Cause and effect. Yes. Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. These solutions. Yes. Since I can't solve the multitudinous detail of what is the cause and effect of this circumstance, then there can't be one. Or then it's, you know, the only possible cause and effect is, you know, take this pill or bow to this statue, make this idol, because I don't know, because otherwise my answers to you are lacking. So what do we do? Is this what our practice should be? Are we trying in our practice every day to remind ourselves it's okay that we know and it's okay that we don't know, and it's okay that we think we know little things today, and it's vital that we doubt them, and it's vital that we doubt the doubting, and it's okay. It's okay, bud. Do your best.
I take a lot of solace in the fact that looking at, say, chapter 5, Gospel of Matthew, Jesus Christ teaching the Beatitudes, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of God. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are, you know, those that mourn, for they shall be comforted, mourn over their own suffering and their own sin. And I take that and I see it in Lao Tzu and the Tao Te Ching. Blessed, you know, is the water that seeks the lowest place. And so to me, what we do, I feel right now in my life, is really asking God's help to experience humility, like to really try to live it and to be okay with all the fumblings and really the inability to catch that greased pig, so to speak. Like it's a crazy, like you said earlier, as soon as you feel you've gained some kind of knowledge of humility, it becomes a joke to say that. And so there's a certain way in which it's always a little bit of a dangerous subject, but we do have to speak of it. It does seem to be a popular subject in the monasteries and certainly in the places of zikr and Sufi worship, this ideal of astaghfirullah, asking for forgiveness in a state of humility. Is it does seem to me open us to iconoclastic, healthy, Manjushri-like swiping of our own, because we're not making so much of ourselves in the wrong way. There's a way in which that kind of wisdom can do her work in a more, or his, the work of wisdom is able to, almost the Holy Spirit can work that more. We gain a kind of muscle for self annihilation or healthy self distrust, or, and that may be self-annihilation is too strong, obviously, if we haven't started in mercy and love and with some sense of, but to me, what we do is try to practice humility and love. And that's it. And what does that look? But specifically, not get overwhelmed and try to work on humility, patience, this, that, to try to pick actual virtues that maybe we want to work on. And mine right now is patience. You know, and being specific and targeted, I guess, in my approach, so I'm not overwhelmed with like trying to do too much in a day, or just being, and there's a certain humility also in just lessening the aim of our spiritual life and just kind of maybe really trusting in, you know, focusing on mercy or focusing, you know, and really embracing that for a few months.
And in combination with praying for that, I mean, the sort of vision of reality that we're talking about here, it's too many, too many computations, you know, it's too much math. You can't be doing that math all the time, you know, trust exhausting. This, but doubt that I'm trusting this, but doubt that I'm doubting it, but doubt that I doubt that I'm trusting.
Not realistic. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I'm going to have to be, now I have to be able to get up off the cushion and maneuver without this computation that I'm not even capable of fully sustaining on the cushion. And so, please, yes. Please, you know, where it is I may pray, where it is that my prayer are received, please, you know, receive these prayers. And
the doing of it is largely the asking. It's at least a good, so
that's
that
true.
That doesn't have, so when you said, well, yeah, but the praying, it's so interesting. I was like, yeah, like it does seem, and I forget a lot. Like, so sometimes just making these verbal, just vocal prayer, or just like, God help me. To just
every
be patient.
Is a prayer.
Yeah.
Everything we do is some prayer for some outcome. Sort, and then do we know the question of what we're praying for is not always present in our mind. But the act of active prayer reminds us that we are in a state of prayer, as we are all day, every day anyway, as everyone is anyway in a state of prayer, as they act with a hope of outcome, but not knowing that they're in a state of prayer. They don't even look to see what outcome they're praying for and get.
That's well said.
Helplessly and that's right into whatever result accidentally comes from the prayer they happen to be making with that action.
There's a great Greek father, and there's a prayer by John Chrysostom, the golden lion-mouthed one, from around, I think he's 300-400, something like this, and he's in the book of prayer, common book of prayer, and he says, you know, God, help me to ask for the right things. Like, don't, and if I'm not, I will just trust whatever you bring. I'll trust that you're answering my prayers, because I barely know what to ask for. So I'm good with whatever comes, you know. This is a nice, so you're not, again, you're not maybe reifying a result that you might think is good for you, but God knows perhaps is not. And now that this gets a little difficult, right? Because for some people, God isn't some other or a being that we talk to. It's more of a principle or a divine truth. And so I don't mean to get uncomfortable there, right? It just is that there did come a point in my life where I would call out, while we've been talking about how God is unknowable, there's a sense in which through, for me, the life of Jesus Christ and the life of other beings, I sense a kind of bridge and a dialogue into the other that is God, not so much focusing on God as myself or the kingdom of God is within, but really engaging in a relationship and how that is just sort of woven into my daily life of my attempt at prayer is contingent upon that. And that is always being reexamined, the notion
of
the,
I can't help but feel like that in a worldview in which God is more of a concept or, you know, an idea of how one might relate to the world, that this, the idea in which the only one hearing our prayers is our own inner heart, that this prayer to an outer God, it would touch that place. Like, I can't help but feel like that prayer would have that same effect, that prayer has to pass through our own heart. And so it doesn't.
Yes.
It doesn't.
What a beautiful thing. That almost maybe doesn't matter. I love that. I love what you just said. That's beautiful. If it's passing through your own heart, of a necessity, it's going to go out to beings or a being or the being or beings upon beings or multitudes of worlds or multitudes of a. It's just, that's a lovely.
Of course, it's an idol. You know, of course, all these, you know, these saps who believe in God, you know, like I'm a Buddhist and I know that my false conception is only my own name, but how it's not somehow God is more of an idol than my own name or I don't get it. You know, it's the same. Of course my name is an idol. And of course, you know, God is an idol the way that I am helpless, but to think about either of those objects. So it's okay. It's okay. We make the prayer knowing that we don't know how to understand what we're praying to, and something seems to be touched. What can you do? What can you do but act and watch the impact on your life and be humble and be patient? Mm. It doesn't happen today. Sometimes it does. Sometimes it does happen today. Sometimes it doesn't happen today. Mm. Sometimes you see your prayers answered by the end of the day. You don't know if that's what happened. You don't know if that's why they were answered. You don't know.
And then sometimes it seems that when a sister like Teresa of Lisieux has embraced her little way with such littleness, that her whole life becomes like a risen prayer. It's answered in me. It seems that there's some place that some people do touch that does include all the suffering and just seems to pull it all up in this life of humility that seems ecstatic. And I think that's exciting. I think it's exciting to talk about humility and try to live it and to fail and to notice it. And it feels very good for the body. It makes the energy in the body, I think, flow better, which is a really good way to see if our meditations or how we're thinking is working, because it's all our thoughts are just inscribed in the lines on our face and the lines that when we do a yoga posture and you see a little fold of skin on your right shoulder that isn't there, the skin becomes like a perfect picture of the state of thoughts in a way. The soul seems to be like tattooed on the way the very folds form as I age. And I don't know why I went there. It's so practical to get our thoughts straight. That's all.
There's this state of aspiration towards a constant state of prayer, right? What we might call samadhi, this state that isn't roused from prayer, that isn't roused from revision of what you see before you, and is not the answer to all problems. You see, it's another tool, and it's a wonderful tool and a powerful tool. And and I believe that this state is possible.
And that's beautiful, because that's saying it's not an end in itself.
It's not.
From a Christian side or a Muslim side, we have to say the God you can't know, that therein lies your telos, your unknowable. The end is to put it in a monotheistic terms, right? We can't. The means should not become ends in the path.
Could there be a being? Could there be a being such that they did not have a thought which was not stained with the color of the desire to love and serve? I believe there could be a being, and that being is better. Is particularly well suited to engage in the work before them, which is not to say there is not work before them. Peace Pilgrim, I read this book about Peace Pilgrim in retreat who walked, I don't know, 60,000 miles or something. Maybe it was 25,000
miles. She died
miles.
In a car crash, for goodness sake. And her
that's
name.
True.
Very
yeah,
odd.
That's true. Oh, yeah, yeah, very odd. Yeah. And she talked about her period of fasting. When she fasted for 45 days under a doctor's watchful care, she said it was during that process that she finally achieved her state of constant prayer, that the prayer never left her after that moment. Famously, Dharmamitra Ji, right, talked about spending a whole year watching the breath from his ajna to Anahata chakra, from the heart to the third eye, back up, you know, every breath, soham on the breath for every single breath for a year, that he didn't miss a single breath. And just on days when I feel like I have an attention that I mean to hold my mind to, just the fact that there could be a day where one day I remembered 10 times and then thought about bullshit the rest of the, you know, billion thoughts that I had that day, but 10 times, it came back a whole 10 times. Now I believe, because it came back a whole 10 times, because I practiced hard enough that it came back a whole 10 times that I remembered this thing that I said, I believe that a person could remember all those thoughts of the day. And then there would really be some work to do. You see, like then the work gets good. The work doesn't stop. Then the work gets good when you have that. And still hard, you know, the work is still hard, but you're buttressed by that support.
And then maybe like Teresa of Lisieux or some, you know, God does the remembering in me, and somehow I've figured out what it is to forget myself so I can truly remember. And then it just, God does the work in me. And that just is, it's interesting. And it is strange that when you see people who seem to have this unbelievable energy and seem to have a somewhat of a stable state of prayer, though not what they would probably describe as a steady state, they do seem to have just extraordinary amounts of energy, and they do seem to engage in certain behaviors that just they don't tend to talk about themselves much. There's certain things I have noticed about people who seem to have done this. So that's helpful too, but also not too much can be made of that either, because it, you know, I don't think, you know, it's always going to look different, perhaps.
So we try, you know, I try, we study, we learn, and the more we study and learn, the great masters tell us to be wary of their words, or at least wary of our understanding of their words for God's sake. And we try, I'm still trying, you know, I'm still studying, I'm still learning, and I'm still trying to remember throughout the day, and just to hold the mind. Like that's the whole, it's not the end. Like you said, it's not the end, but it's the practice, like the whole practice, like what could be revealed to me if I could hold my mind all day on that.
And it's interesting that you brought up Peace Pilgrim and you brought up asceticism, and I'm making these last 2 years forays into fasting, which is a subject for another time, but that there is something about the appetites and bringing them into a certain kind of corralling them, I guess, not controlling, but like, just that there's something to removing food for a while, or removing certain things that we do, whatever it can lead to understandings and greater stability, and then food can be kind of brought back in slowly, and just our relationship to anything that we use to sustain ourselves and others, that deeply sacred connection to that which sustains the body and the soul. It's almost as if your sight and your hearing and your smell and your taste and is given back to us when we put less in. There's a way in which they're cleansed and stilled a little so that they can really maybe see the light on the water and the color of the green and the trees, and everything maybe a little more vibrant. But that can be taken too far too. And I do agree with the idea that it really in the end it's why we're engaging in actions and where our mind is at. That's the main thing. But I do feel there's a profound effect of the physical body deeply affects how we think. And so I'm interested. Yeah. It's interesting that you brought up her fasting and, you know, and in light of my, like, you know, feeling this in the body, like feeling the effects of, see, I want to say proper thinking, but it's so risky. Feeling the effects of merciful thinking and mercy to ourselves and others, how the body, the tensions in the body are affected by our thoughts so deeply, and that it can be a real help to see where we're at, to see what's going on in the body, kind of nakedly looking at ourselves and seeing like, oh my gosh, I got pain here and pain there. And there, sometimes it can be seemingly traced back to ways of thinking. There's such an emotional basis for it. So,
I mean, in the times I hope that one can do this with joy, and I think that you seem to be doing a fine job of doing it with greater joy. But in the times that I starved myself, you know, of stimulus in the most radical ways, when I got bored of the outside world such that my mind finally was willing to spend time inside. Mm. When the same thing happened day in and day out again and again, I do the same activities, I eat the same foods, and it's just not that interesting. And then the engagement that was possible inside, just out of nothing, out of just not enough going on outside. And now this inner world takes on this new splendor because it's what's available. And I long for it. I long for the feelings that I had in that splendor. Now, the sense of asceticism now for me, it's like the wrong taste, what I would have to do to get back there. It was very painful for me. And I wouldn't recommend that to people. I wouldn't ask people to hurt themselves or to break their own will in that way. I don't know. Mm. I don't know. I don't know that I would recommend for anyone to do that. I dream of it happening naturally and joyfully. And I think this is something we can pray for, is another thing we can pray.
I think
pray
so too. And then thinking of the, I had a Sufi teacher for a while. He said, Shreya Bishreya, slowly, slowly. So sometimes the actions do involve some warfare, something a little bit tough sometimes, but that only, it's all the medicine, just it changes as the years and decades go by. And, but mostly for me now that the habit, the asceticism, there's a certain asceticism in healthy distrust, the sort of, if you will, an asceticism of the mind. And I think maybe fasting and yogas and physical are kind of an effect of having engaged in some sort of prayerful asceticism of the mind. It almost feels like a person might naturally want to fast or spend time in solitude grappling with things if having engaged in some of the things we've talked about today.